Charles, we literally met you like 2 days ago, and you're pulling up to the studio, so you are like our man on the inside as a white guy that knows pretty much everything about the Middle East. So,
Yeah,
wait,
bro, you were the talk of the evening at the event, the Jackson Market event, the post-Oscar celebration.
was it really?
Yeah, bro, people loved you.
Oh, that's.
They loved what you're working on, and we'd love to. That's why we want to have you here to share with the world, with you know, our audience and stuff, and let them know what you're working on and more
You
about
also.
yourself.
You also hosted the Oscars, didn't you?
I didn't host the Oscars. I went
I
to an Oscar party.
Okay, nice. Close enough.
This guy's spreading misinformation right off the bat. Like,
hey, yeah. What happened to Mr. Information?
Yeah.
Everybody's spreading misinformation. I mean, how does
Mr. Information feel about it?
Spreading misinformation is my job. Very good. That's what the CIA pays.
Disinformation.
Yeah, no, you do have some
oh
like.
God, I've invited
you do
CIA
have some inside
guy.
Man like
vibes.
CIA, making sure these Arabs are not doing too much.
Now that I think about it, that what's his name, the guy from Narcos. Yeah, you got a similar vibe.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Okay, I like that so much better. I usually get Macaulay Culkin, and that
one. Okay,
just
okay
kind
now
of
that you say that, you shouldn't have said that.
That's funny. I do get the vibe from the dude from Narcos. That's funny.
So I used to have a mustache.
Oh, that'd have been even
it was
better.
A lot. Yeah, I used to get that a lot more.
That's hilarious.
So
is that your filmmaker mustache? Like when you're in the field, you got it with the aviators and the.
Ironically, I actually haven't had it since I've been making films.
Okay.
Yeah, it's
for
been.
It's called manhandle. Or
I got rid of it like last year, actually, like kind of right before I went to Lebanon.
Okay.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
That's
How was
you,
that?
That's when you needed it the most, brother.
I know. Need to blend in a little bit. No, there was no way. I wasn't. There was no way to go undercover in Lebanon. It's still like a sore thumb.
Right.
All over the place, especially in Shatila Camp.
So Charles, you're a filmmaker. You're producing currently a film about the realities of Palestine. You'll tell us more about it.
Yeah. So about this time last year, I went to Lebanon. Well, let me back up a little bit. So I was in Turkey with the World Central Kitchen a couple years ago after the earthquake. Several of the members of the team that I was on got killed in that Israeli airstrike in Gaza.
The ones that in the World Central Kitchen?
Yeah. Where they said it was a
mistake. They were targeted?
Where they were targeted.
Yeah.
Like, oops, we just airstruck three different cars.
Twice.
As
again,
they were traveling.
Clearly
right?
marked. I mean, and you can see.
And
I mean,
clearly
can,
marked from the drone. Yeah.
I remember I gave a interview to one of those Turkish outlets, and I talked about how, like, you know, it would have been impossible for them to mistakenly identify that vehicle.
Can
and then they
briefly.
Retargeted it. So.
Tell us briefly why.
Well, I think what ended up happening, did you guys ever read that report about the Lavender AI system?
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I think probably what happened is it got caught on that, and then someone just, like, pressed to kill. Because it looked really bad for the Israelis for that to happen. That was one of the big things that started to sort of undo their narrative in the Western imagination.
Yeah,
because you were telling me about Jose Andres and how he was kind of like a hardcore on one side, and then...
Jose Andres was like committed Zionist out the gate after October 7th and like made that very vocal. And then, you know, what happened is he went to Palestine. And something about that experience tends to bring you face to face with the realities of life there.
Right.
And he started to change his tune. Before that, I was following his journey with that, and it was really funny because, you know, he'd start recording these videos from Gaza, and he'd be like, Salaam Alaikum, you know, he's like talking to everybody, and you see he's kind of getting into the culture. And then by the time his employees were killed, then he just like flew into a rage and pointed the finger squarely at the Israeli government.
He's the head of the...
He's a big time chef that is also the leader of the
World Central
Kitchen.
I see.
Which, by the way, is a very effective disaster relief organization.
Mm-hmm. They were here for the fires too.
Yeah. Well, and they can get on the ground. I mean, so this is my world. Like I've worked in disaster relief for 3 or 4 years now. They can get on the ground really quickly because they basically just turn every restaurant in the affected area into a distribution station. So Jose has this saying. He says, everyone is an employee of World Central Kitchen. They just don't know it yet. So you never know when some disaster is going to strike.
Right.
And then they reach out to you and say, hey, so you own a falafel shop. Okay, well, now your falafel shop is going to be paid to distribute free meals for your community.
That sounds very... in a benevolent way, very like maniacal.
Yeah, you just don't, you don't know you're an employee.
You're gonna, yes, you're gonna serve your community.
But, talking about you know, distributing food, let's go back to the Shatila camp and your time in Lebanon.
Right. So, you know, I was like, I was kind of waiting for the right thing to take me over to the Middle East, which, by the way, I'd never been to. I mean, I was in Turkey. You know, I near the Kurdish kind of regions, very close to the border of Syria. But that was, I mean, that was the closest I'd been to actually being in the Middle East. And I was waiting for the right story or thing to come up where I could basically do more than just yap about all of this on TikTok and Instagram, because that's kind of my, like, I think
that's the thing, right? You kind of talk to the camera. Yeah.
Well, I mean, but my thing is, I think a lot of people talk to the camera. I think very few people actually act on their beliefs.
Sure.
And I think it's really weird, especially like on the left, people in leftist circles, they think that leftism or socialism is like something you do on the internet, which I've just always thought was really weird. Or that solidarity is something, it's like posting the right things, like reposting the right infographics.
Yeah.
Not actually doing the stuff.
Yeah. Versus organizing and getting out there.
So I was waiting for kind of the right thing to express my solidarity and use the skill set that I've been given to do that. And then I had a buddy, he was a journalist in Lebanon. He's like, I've happened upon a story here about how the UNRWA allegations stemming from Gaza are going to end up shutting down programs here in Lebanon, because UNRWA also takes care of, you know, obviously 5.9 million Palestinians spread around refugee camps in Jordan, Lebanon, Syria. And I was kind of told him, like, hey, like, I got to hold off on this. You know, I'm still, like, kind of recovering, honestly, from some short-term PTSD from Ukraine. And then the World Central Kitchen strike, and I was just, like, filled with rage for, like, 48 hours. And I called him. I said, I'm going to find the money for us to do this, and I'll be over there within, like, 72 hours.
Wow.
And so that's how it started.
From Turkey you went to?
No. I went from Los Angeles. Oh, okay. I was so jet-lagged. Wow. Flew into Beirut. And that was my first time in the Middle East. Yeah, within, like, I guess, the night I arrived in Beirut. Was the night that Iran fired all of those missiles.
You got a fireworks show.
We did.
Yeah.
And everyone thought that Israel was going to invade that night as a response. And so my first night in the Middle East almost started World War III.
That's crazy.
But it was really cool. And it was actually really beautiful, because I was staying in this, like, kind of cool, like, hostel apartment thing in the Hamra district of Beirut. Hamra, yeah. And everyone was just super cool. And they're like, this is life in Lebanon.
Yeah.
You know, we're under the threat of this all the time. And let's just enjoy ourselves and have a party. So we all stayed up and we played pool.
It's the most Lebanese.
Yeah, we played pool till like 4 o'clock in the morning, just waiting. I was so jet lagged that I was like staying up anyway.
Yeah.
That was my first night in the Middle East. Well, wow. Proper Middle East, the Arab world, I guess.
You almost got into a war and you had a party, sounds.
Yeah, sounds very Lebanese for sure. But and then when did you end up going to the camps?
I guess we got into the camps like 72 hours into my trip, you know, recover from jet lag a little bit. Yeah. Had to sort of set up a network of local contacts. I threw up a bunch of stories on my Instagram saying, hey, I'm filming in Lebanon. And I mean, you probably understand how, like, the Lebanese-Palestinian grapevine works. People were emailing me within, like, hours of posting that, being like, yep, if you need a place to stay, if you need translators, everything.
Yeah.
And so I met two wonderful people who worked at the – they volunteered at the – one had been raised in Shatila camp, and the other volunteered at the chess club there. She taught chess to these kids. And so we went in there and we met the kids from the chess club and we went to the UNRWA schools, and it was a really fascinating experience. You know, obviously Shatila camp can be a bit hostile to people who are coming in there without, like, very clear intentions, especially, you know, someone who looks like me. And obviously Beirut is crawling with spies all the time. I mean, all the world's intelligence agencies, especially the Israelis. So people are naturally suspicious of, like, a Westerner walking around refugee camp with a camera, where there are like seven active Palestinian militant organizations as well as Hezbollah.
Wow.
But everyone was super cool, because I was with this, like, woman who's there every day teaching chess to the kids, and everyone was very welcoming. Incredibly generous people. And these are people, you know, raised in a Palestinian refugee camp, have absolutely nothing. And so they're the most hospitable people I've ever encountered.
Yeah, man. Yeah. Such a dichotomy of our culture of like, no matter what you have, even if it is nothing, you still give to the next person.
It's funny you mention that. So I'm from South Carolina, mm-hmm. which, right, that's the South. That's famously Southern hospitality.
Mm-hmm. Not the same?
Not the same. No. Southern hospitality doesn't hold a candle to Arab hospitality.
Hot take.
They're not even in the same.
That's a hook.
They're not even in the same category, I would say. Yeah.
But definitely more hospitable than like other parts of the U.S., I would say that the South.
Right, but that's a very low bar.
Fair enough.
Right.
Fair enough. What are some things you observed, like actions that you were...
It's like the shirt off your back thing, you know?
Any examples?
I think one of the things... We filmed like a little... We were going to do like a little promo reel because one of the kids who was an UNRWA student, we were interviewing him and kind of getting to know his story, and he was sharing his concerns about UNRWA getting, you know, dismantled and everything, and what that was going to mean for his future. And I said, "Well, what do you want to do?" And he says, "Oh, I want to be a chef." And so we ended up filming a sizzle of like going all around Shatila Camp collecting ingredients, and then he brought us back to his parents' home, and they cooked us this like marvelous meal, and he was making a tabbouleh, and he we went all over, and they welcomed us, and they, you know, rolled out the red carpet and the nice chairs and the nice utensils, everything they had, and these people are living in like a crumbling house in a Palestinian refugee camp. The only budget which repairs that house is attached to UNRWA, which has been cut by the United States as a result of October 7th, and here they are rolling out the red carpet for a Canadian and an American whose tax dollars are explicitly going to wipe out their cousins in Gaza. Wow. It was a really humbling experience. Yeah, and that was repeated not only in Shatila camp, but when I went to Amman and when I went to the West Bank. Honestly, it brought me to tears at a couple points, just the dissonance of that moment. Mm. Like these people have no reason to be hospitable to me at all.
They have nothing.
Yeah, they have nothing to share in. And I thought about, you know, living in LA, living in this place of complete opulence and plenty.
Yeah.
And everyone's so sad. Everyone's so depressed and so insular. You know, we lead these lives of like hyper individualized everything.
Yeah.
Little suburban neighborhoods. People don't even know their neighbors.
So who truly has nothing? You know?
Yeah. I mean, that's, yeah. I mean, like.
Bars.
We are the philosopher over here.
No, I mean, seriously, it's like, yeah, no material, you know, maybe not as much wealth, but the rich in culture and heritage and love, and that's what really matters, right?
I mean, truly, it is what really matters. Like, it's actually what extends your life.
Yeah.
People now say that, like, not having friends is worse than smoking for your health.
That's made by big tobacco for sure.
Yeah.
Hey man, you don't got any friends? Pick up a cigarette.
Yeah.
Now there are studies that show that socializing is one of the indicators of longevity and having like a healthy social life.
Sure. Yeah, there was actually like a really interesting study came out a couple years ago, and it was kind of talking about happiness and like how we perceive happiness.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, about 50% of happiness is genetic. Mm. So, you know, if you lose the genetic lottery, there's a high chance you're going to be kind of depressed.
Mm. Thanks, mom and dad.
Yeah. But then you can add about 10% to your happiness by getting, like, the American dream.
Mm.
Perfect house, perfect kids, perfect wife in the school, you know, Ivy League education and job opportunity. You can add about 10%
to your happiness.
Only 10%.
Wow.
You can add another 10% to your happiness by just having two or three friends that you see on a weekly basis.
Wow. Okay.
That is the equivalent of achieving everything the American dream.
What if you don't like those friends?
Right, yeah.
Can you take away?
We love those friends, but we don't like those friends.
Listen, being annoyed is the price that you pay for a community.
It's like brotherly love.
Mm.
Yeah, yeah.
Bars, man. I'm not a philosopher. <That's you. laughs>
Damn, we got a bars off over here.
Yeah.
But, yeah, so... Talking about more about the filmmaker angle.
And the film itself.
Where is that going? What's the timeline of events? And
what's it about?
So the movie, it's about the UNRWA.
Them
cutting the funding for UNRWA and, right, how it affects.
Yeah, so, you know, it starts right after October 7th, where actually it was a couple months after October 7th, Israel publishes this report saying all of these UNRWA personnel were involved in the October 7th massacre, mm-hmm. Which is, of course, clear evidence that involved as in, like, directly participated or offered material assistance to the people who did it.
Sounds
basically
like
saying
fake news to me.
Yeah, well, basically saying everyone in UNRWA
manufactured consent to go in and destroy it.
Precisely. Yeah. Well, and people who understand this understand that Israel's been going after UNRWA for years. Why? Because UNRWA is an internationally recognized organization that only exists because of the Nakba. Mm-hmm. It is authorized by all of the UN co-signer countries to deal specifically with the Palestinian refugee crisis. It cannot, like, its mandate cannot legally end under international law until there is a political resolution to the Palestine question. Mm. That is very inconvenient for Israel.
Yeah.
Especially when you think about the fact that this is an international entity that has all of the records of all of the families who were displaced by the Nakba going back 76 years.
Wow.
So that is a huge historical, cultural, and legal threat to the Israeli narrative.
Right.
And their framework for understanding the occupation of Palestine.
Mm-hmm. And a point of accountability, like, until the issue is resolved.
Exactly. So what better way to get rid of it than to claim it's a terrorist organization, which is legally what they have done. The Israeli Knesset has passed a law saying that UNRWA is a terrorist organization. This has never happened in history.
It's insane.
It is wild. There's no precedent for a United Nations organization being labeled a terrorist organization and getting kicked out of the country. It's never happened before.
And they're doing it with Al Jazeera and all these other nationally recognized or internationally recognized news companies.
Yeah, but UNRWA is helping refugees.
Well, in terms
of they're not journalists. UNRWA's are not journalists. They're healthcare workers.
It's
UN.
How are the UN terrorists, bro? Like, maybe you're the terrorist.
Israel is like a co-signatory to the UN. I mean, they're a part of the United Nations.
Right.
Sure. It's completely unprecedented.
Yeah.
Another thing that makes UNRWA different is that UNRWA is the only UN organization that is predominantly composed of people from the country in which it operates. So it's specifically set up for Palestinian refugees, and about 60,000 Palestinians work directly for the organization. Again, very inconvenient if your goal is to ethnically cleanse Palestine and erase its history. And so now they're really managing to successfully discredit this organization, not from like a legal perspective, but from a practical perspective. Mm-hmm. They've convinced the United States and some other nations who are responsible for funding UNRWA to completely remove their funding. There were multiple investigations which revealed that even if there was UNRWA involvement in October 7th, it was to such a vanishingly small degree as to not basically not even be statistically significant inside the organization. Doesn't matter. The United States gives $300 million to the organization, which comprises about a third of its budget. That was completely cut, and the Congress actually passed a law saying that we cannot even consider restoring UNRWA funding until June of this year, 2025.
Our Congress?
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Yeah, so for a whole year now, almost, UNRWA funding has been cut off from the United States. There's been a lot of private fundraising. Mm-hmm. The government of Qatar also stepped in, and they've pledged like $100 million to UNRWA. But it's still in very dire straits.
I mean, I'm kind of involved in a much smaller capacity with Human Appeal, raising funds for Shutzi, like a lot of the camps and places in Lebanon too. And one of the main person that approached me to do that is going in April to distribute similar mission to you guys. So
yeah. There's something deeply sad about the Palestinian situation in Lebanon in the camps. I mean, because, you know, the sectarian system just completely shuts out Palestinians from having a voice, having careers, having jobs.
Right.
I mean, Lebanese citizenship, I mean, they can't do anything. You know, if you want to be a doctor, you have to be a doctor inside Shatila refugee camp.
Yeah, I mean, we all have our own bones to pick with our own governments, too. And, you know, we just hope that we can only hope, because if there is no hope, then what's the point? You know, so we just keep pushing and keep doing the good work that you're doing, and hopefully we can spread the message and push your film that's coming out. Is it like, what's the date for that?
We don't. I mean, so right now we're trying to fundraise to go back and finish the doc in the West Bank. We have to go and interview all of our UNRWA personnel that got kicked out of East Jerusalem by the Israelis. And then we have to interview the Israelis and ask them why they kicked them out. So we hope to accomplish that either by the end of this month or next. And I really want this documentary to be out by June. So it's going to be a very expedited sort of post-production thing.
And so if you had to like sum up the goal of the documentary and the needs of it for people watching, either interested in consuming it or helping.
Yeah, I would say so. I did this in collaboration with a Canadian journalist who thought that the combination of me as an activist and him as a journalist would be a good way to sort of investigate these allegations about October 7th and everything. So it is, I mean, we do maintain standards of journalistic integrity as we approach this question. I'm asking UNRWA personnel very difficult questions about like, you know, to what degree do you feel like UNRWA actually is affected by Palestinian militant organizations or offers refuge to them and that sort of thing. And I'd be asking the same thing of the Israelis. At first, my personal goal as an activist and someone who believes in Palestinian liberation was to raise awareness about what could happen to UNRWA. But this story accelerated so much that the Israelis have already banned the organization from East Jerusalem. They're beginning to stop its shipments into Gaza, and they want to ban it throughout the entire West Bank. So this might actually end up just being a witness to the downfall of UNRWA, after all, depending on when it's released. So especially with the new administration and the new American government, I'm not particularly confident that the U.S. Congress is going to green light $300 million for an organization that Israel says is a terrorist organization. Yeah. So as far as I see it, my responsibility is to tell this story no matter what happens with UNRWA. So at least people can know this is what happened to the only organization out there that's caring for 5.9 million Palestinian refugees all across the Middle East.
Yeah. Man, that's an important story to tell. We appreciate you taking that upon yourself, you and your partner.
Charles, if there's any other way we could help, you know, or any way that the viewers can and listeners can help, you know, feel free to let them know. And we're going to spread this as much as we can, too.
What's your timeline for funding, and what's the needs?
I mean, we're hoping to raise about 60K between now and the end of March so that we can go back and film and then immediately go into post-production and turn that around as rapidly as possible. That's the immediate goal. We have a crowdfunding campaign. I'm talking to people in Los Angeles. I'm talking to people overseas to see if we can get this done. We've had some generous support previously that allowed us to do the first part, but it's hard to get a documentary about Palestine and Palestinians funded through conventional channels.
Sure. Well, we'll definitely link to any of the fundraising campaigns you have. And if anyone watching has any connections in that world, then please do help support our brother Charles in telling this important story. And I appreciate you coming.
What's your favorite Arabic word?
That's a tough one.
He knows quite a few. He's surprised.
Do you?
Yeah.
I don't really say that. I was impressed. He called me an expert on the Middle East, and you say I know a lot of Arabic. Both of those maths are about to be unveiled. I was thinking, oh, wait, hang on. I feel like this is a slightly archaic Arabic word, and I'm going to be completely honest. I discovered this through playing Assassin's Creed Mirage.
Nice. Okay.
Okay. But, like, I think it's...
Go ahead, go for it.
Wafakaka
Allah. Wafakaka Allah.
So he's going like straight Quranic
Allah.
Arabic.
It's Fusha, yeah.
Fusha Arabic.
Yeah.
What did you call me?
The colloquial way to say it is Allah Wafak. So the other way.
Allah Wafak.
Yeah, Allah Wafak.
Allah
Wafak.
Yeah. And right, Charles,
Allah Wafak.
Allah Wafak.
In your journey and your mission. We appreciate you, Habib.
And you. I think that is our time. So any other things you want to plug, or are you good?
Yeah, I mean, you can follow my personal channels. I talk a lot about Palestine. Some people say I talk too much about Palestine. Charles McBride with a Y, not an I.
Nice.
Quality content. We met, and you were telling me about your friend with the whole Lord of the Rings stuff and everything. It was.
Oh, yeah.
You make high-quality content, and thanks for doing it. And I want to go with you to Lebanon next time you go.
I would love that.
Yeah. I'll be your translator.
I'm going to need an extra translator.
Yeah, he needs a translator for your translator.
I know most of the words, but...
You'll pass it on to him.
All right. Well, awesome, thank you, Charles.
Thanks, guys. Appreciate it.